Good morning. My name's John Alterman. I run the Middle East program at CSIS. I am delighted to be back at work for what feels like will be at least sort of a normal day. And I'm delighted to welcome you, and I'm delighted to see a room full of people. Ambassador Sanderson and I were talking about our pleasure at seeing a room full of people who are interested in North Africa. Not so many years ago, it might have been a far-fetched idea that you could get a room of such an impressive breadth to look at issues of common concern. We're having this conference today for a couple of reasons. The first is that, to our mind, North Africa receives too little attention in Washington. The region has considerable resources, not only oil and gas deposits in close proximity to Europe, kinship ties that reach deep into Europe, and a young and robust labor force, but it's often an afterthought in a Middle East policy community that's focused on conflicts raging to the east. We had an all-day conference on North Africa 2 years ago, and I'm hard-pressed to remember a similar event in Washington in the years since. The second reason is that, to our mind, North Africa receives too little attention when people discuss violent extremism. While violence has declined in Algeria since the 1990s, domestic terrorism remains a serious concern for every country in North Africa, and it often spills over. North African networks have carried out a range of attacks in Europe and beyond, and not only the 2004 train bombing in Madrid. In 2005, my colleague Tony Cordesman estimated that there were almost twice as many Algerians fighting as Saudis with the insurgency in Iraq. Networks of North African fundraisers, recruiters, and operatives operate around the world, often relying on criminal activity to generate their funds. One of the most disturbing trends is how global many of these movements are professing to become. In 2007, an Algerian group called the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, or GSPC, swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda and took the name Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The world has a great deal of experience dealing with terrorism in the name of nationalism, but it has a much more checkered record dealing with millennialist utopians who seek to upend the global order. All of this has gotten the attention of the U.S. government, as you can see from both our panelists today and also from our audience. As the nature of extremism has evolved, U.S. ties with North Africa have also evolved. Today, the U.S. has friendly relations with every single government in the region. This provides a unique opportunity for the U.S. to work closely with regional allies bilaterally while simultaneously promoting greater regional cooperation among those allies. We're convening this conference in order to shed light on the complexities of fighting extremism in the Maghreb and to highlight opportunities for greater regional cooperation in fighting the spread of extremism. We hope to clarify some of these questions, to gain a better understanding of these complex issues, and in the process raise new questions that should be answered. Questions like, what is the likely trajectory of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in terms of strategy, targets, and capabilities? How do criminal activity and terrorism intersect in the region and beyond? What are the different strategies that regional governments use to counter radicalization? And how should the United States seek to strengthen stability in the Maghreb and work with regional allies to fight extremism? We're fortunate to have an outstanding and knowledgeable group of speakers. All have firsthand experience in the region as U.S. government officials, law enforcement agents, journalists, and academics. I can't think of a better group of people to frame this discussion of the dynamics of North African terror. And before we get too far into this, I want to thank the many North African officials I spoke with in preparation for this conference and the embassies of North African countries for their encouragement. I'd also like to recognize Mr. Ahmed Shadi, member of the CSIS International Advisory Board and chairman of Maroc Telematique Media Group, who is very encouraging as well. Just in terms of logistics, there is food and coffee around the corner. If we need the room, we'll open up the back and get more room so we won't get too cramped in this room. We will have lunch at 12, followed by our keynote address, and then we'll break. It is my pleasure to welcome Dov Zakheim, not only because Dov is a friend, but also because Dov finally got here, fighting through the worst of Washington traffic. Dov is a senior advisor here at CSIS from 2001 to 2004. He served as the Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller and the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Defense. He serves on a wider variety of volunteer boards than anybody I know. He chairs the National Intelligence Council International Business Practices Advisory Panel, is a member of the Defense Business Board, which he helped establish, the Secretary of the Navy's Advisory Board, and the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel, on which we serve together. I'm leaving some off. It's really an impressive record of volunteer service. He received his bachelor's degree summa cum laude from Columbia, a doctorate in economics and politics at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. So I'm pleased to give you Dov Zakheim, who will introduce the first panel. Thank you.
Thank you. This is I'm just the moderator, so I appreciate all the nice words, but you're not going to hear much from me other than who wants to ask a question. Just a couple of thoughts before I introduce the panel. John laid it out extremely well. One thing that we often forget is that precisely because we have good relations with virtually all the countries in the Maghreb now, we have a tendency not to focus as much on them as we should, because the U.S. government always pays attention to the squeaky wheel. And we have a lot of squeaky wheels right now. If you think, I won't give you the entire list, but if you think about it, we currently have troops committed either to zones where they're being fired at or zones where they could be fired at any time, in 11 different places around the world. None of those places are in North Africa. And so we tend to overlook the fact that, as John mentioned, you've got extremists and terrorists in this part of the world. We have seen just now, both, I guess, with the capture of Mr. Baradar in Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever they captured him, on the one hand, and what's going on in Yemen on the other, that things keep popping up all over the place. And it isn't a simple, I'll win here and therefore I win kind of equation. So focusing on this part of the world is crucial, particularly because we don't focus enough on this part of the world, and should. And we do have three experts. I'll introduce each one of them before they speak. We'll begin with ladies first. Janet Sanderson has a long and distinguished career in the State Department. She was mentioning to me when I walked in that it was precisely because of the wonderful weather and the difficulty of getting around that she liked serving overseas, particularly if you hear the places she served in, where there tends not to be much snow. She's been to Haiti, which, of course, is a handful, but no snow there. Was ambassador from 2006 to 2009. Before that, she was our ambassador to Algeria. Snow in some parts, but I suspect not where you were. And she's been deputy chief of mission in Amman, economics minister, counselor in Cairo. She served in Kuwait. She served in Tel Aviv. She served in the Emirates. This is someone who really knows the world that she is about to discuss, with a BA from William & Mary, an MA from the Naval War College, fluent in French and Arabic. All in all, someone that we are ready and delighted to hear from. So, Secretary Sanderson, over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I don't want you to think that I have decided to come back to Washington simply to get into the middle of snow and traffic again. If there's anything the last couple of weeks have convinced me, there is something to be said about being overseas. But it's a real pleasure for me to be here and talk a bit about North Africa. One of the reasons I am here is because Assistant Secretary Feltman called me up when I was sitting in my office in Port-au-Prince and said, I think it's really time that we focus on North Africa again. This is something that the Secretary wants to do, it's something that the President wants to do, and I want you to be part of that. So it was a real pleasure for me to come back and to take up the job as Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Maghreb and also for the Arab Gulf about 4 or 5 months ago. But let me take you back a little while to September 11, 2001. I was actually in a car coming back from Tizi Ouzou, which was the capital of the Kabylie, when I got a phone call from my deputy chief of mission telling me about the attacks in New York and Washington. And in so many ways, for us on the ground in Algiers, that was a game changer in the way that it was for you here in Washington and for all of us around the world. The Algerians, of course, had their own experience, their own war on terrorism. There are those that would argue it's a civil war. To me, it was much more complicated than that, and I refer to that period from about 1991 to 2001 as the Décennie du Cauchemar, the nightmare decade, which is how the Algerians refer to it. But what it did for us is it kickstarted a relationship that we had with Algeria and a broader relationship with the rest of the Maghreb on the counterterrorism front. Of course, the Algerians had had a lot of experience with this, some of it productive, some of it not so. And their experience, I think, if not set the stage, certainly reminded us of the complexity of trying to get our hands around this phenomenon, not only in the world, in our own backyard, but also in North Africa. You know, the Algerians themselves had had a plane, an Air France flight that was hijacked in 94. And one of the notes I got after 9/11 was from a woman who tore out a page of a notebook, and she said, "I know what it was like. I was on the Air France plane that was hijacked to Marseille." The Algerians also had experiences seeing their terrorism exported to Europe. There were attacks in Paris in the mid-90s in metros, as you may recall. And, of course, there were those who fled Algeria and moved to Italy, to Spain, to France, and to London and elsewhere to begin thinking about next steps and thinking about how to perpetuate the terrorism and the experiences that they had learned in Algeria. But the Algerian experience, no matter how unique it was not the only experience of terrorism in the region during those 3 years that I was on the ground in the Maghreb. You may recall, of course, there was the bombing in Djerba in Tunisia, and there was the bombing in Casablanca, which shocked us all. So as we looked at the Maghreb at the time, it became very clear to us that not only did we have a lot to learn, but that there was really a need to try and develop a much more cohesive and much more coherent approach to terrorism and to try and find ways to build relations with the countries of the region, learn from their experiences, both good and bad, and encourage the type of intelligence sharing, training, and open dialogue that, frankly, had not necessarily existed before, except in certain areas. I regret to say that despite those efforts early in this decade, terrorism has continued in the Maghreb, as you are aware. There were additional bombings in Casablanca. In Algeria, although President Bouteflika was able to present his civil concord and essentially eliminate or neutralize the GIA, the GSPC, which became a very active group, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, I know, moved to the Kabylie and started launching additional attacks on Algerian government officials and others, as well as foreigners and civilian targets. And in Libya, which at that time, of course, was a country that we were not paying enormous attention to, the Libyan regime had battled with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group for a long time. And by 2007, LIFG had made accommodations with al-Qaeda, and it was only through the efforts of the Qatafi Development Foundation, led by the leader's son, Saif, where efforts were made by the Libyans to neutralize, to rehabilitate, and reintegrate former LIFG members in society. As a result, as you are probably aware, last year the organization renounced its affiliation with AQIM, and you know there are those that would argue that that might well be a model for the future for others. And then, of course, during the decade, there have been attacks in Mauritania, which exacerbated the problems there as that country went through political crisis after political crisis after political crisis. At the same time, we saw an export of North African extremists sending their terrorists and their terrorism to Europe and the Middle East. As you are aware, the Moroccans were involved in the 2004 bombing of the Madrid train station. The Tunisians have raised money and provided logistical support for terrorist groups in Europe. And at one point, North Africans were believed to compose approximately one-third of the foreign fighters in Iraq. while the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was residing in the AFPAC region in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Southwest Asia. That being said, I have to tell you that there have been some real progress over the last couple of years. In Algeria itself, this nightmare decade came to a close, and although there have been some positive steps and perhaps some few steps forward, on the whole, Algeria is a much more stable and secure state than it was when I arrived in 2000. The government granted amnesty. As I said earlier, the GSPC fled to the Kabylie. Was relatively limited to anywhere between 300 and 500, depending on what figures you believe. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group had fled to Libya and set up shop in Pakistan, where it refocused its efforts elsewhere, which, of course, opened another problem. And there were other organizations that were beginning to basically fall apart as the governments of the area reached out to each other, as they worked in concert, as they worked with the United States and others in the international community, and as they made a concerted effort to try and address the problem in their homelands. I would argue that the establishment of AQIM, the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic lands of the Maghreb, provided for these disintegrating or deteriorating organizations a convenient hook. It allowed existing insurgent organizations who perhaps their original raison d'etre had passed, and they were looking desperately for a new cause on which to hang their hat. Now, I also will be blunt. The United States gave them a little bit of help, first by our engagement in Iraq and later with some of our activities in Southwest Asia. Where the region remains a problem, I think, in terms of dealing with terrorism, it's very well known. The region still provides a source of recruits, logistics, and financing. This is one of the things that came up in my conversations. I recently went to the Maghreb, stopped in Morocco, in Tunisia, and in Algeria. And it was very clear that the governments of the region are quite concerned about this trend and are trying to get their hands around it. There is a lot of debate here in Washington and elsewhere about AQIM, and I know that you're going to hear Ambassador Godec this afternoon at the lunch, and he has a fairly long discussion of it. But one of the questions we as a government are trying to grapple with is what is the relationship between AQIM and Al-Qaeda? That question, frankly, from my perspective, is still open. Experts continue to debate the extent to which AQIM is controlled or even connected to Al-Qaeda. But at the end of the day, let's be honest, it really doesn't matter. Whether it works in a concert with Al-Qaeda, whether it works alone, whether the AQIM brand allows it to have a certain profile that these groups might not have otherwise, these are all irrelevant as long as the bombings, the kidnappings, and the terrorist attacks continue. So I would argue that given their experience, given the events of the last decade, given how AQIM has emerged in the region, the Maghreb governments are among our best allies in the fight against terrorism. For instance, I would note that it was through their efforts primarily to monitor cross-border movements and share information that the flow of foreign fighters from and through North Africa to Iraq was virtually brought to a standstill. That is a factoid, frankly, that is not very well known, but from our perspective in the U.S. government, it really does get to the point of the efforts of the Maghreb governments to fight terrorism. Now, there are enormous challenges to this effort. Despite regional suspicions and political obstacles, or which are very familiar, Western Sahara immediately comes to mind. The Maghreb countries, I think, and certainly the message I took away from my own trip, are united in their battle against extremists. They cooperate on an ongoing basis through information sharing and other bilateral and multilateral efforts. It is some days better than others, but on the whole, it is a system that works fairly well. I would note with regard to AQIM that although we tend to focus now on the fact that it's pretty much migrated into northern Mali and the areas in the Sahel, and I know there'll be a fair amount of discussion about that, it still remains directed to a certain extent at Algeria. And although I would argue it doesn't pose an existential threat to the Algerian government, it has certainly continued to cause the Algerians problems. And I would also note that it has not been able to establish a beachhead in any of the other Maghreb states. Instead, it is pushed downwards to those what we like to call ungoverned territories of the Sahel, northern Mali, Niger, Chad, Mauritania to a certain extent. They've developed local alliances. They have worked either directly or indirectly with local officials. They are looking for ways, frankly, to exploit areas where there isn't a great government presence. One of the things that we are very pleased, one of the events that we're very pleased to see develop over the last couple of years is the recognition among the Maghreb states that all countries in the region bear responsibility for addressing this threat to regional security and stability. Algeria, for instance, is working not only with its neighbors in the Maghreb, but also very closely with Mali and the other Sahelian countries to unify their efforts against AQIM. Given the varying degrees of capacity and trust, the level and pace of this cooperation perhaps is not where it needs to be at this point. But we, the U.S. government, continue to encourage this cooperation and to offer our support. When I was in the region a couple of weeks ago, that was one of the messages I took away. Regardless of domestic political considerations and some of those obstacles between countries that I talked about, and some of the misunderstandings that arise between neighbors from time to time, it was very clear at each government official's office that trying to find a way to get their hands around AQIM, to try and find a regional solution to this problem, which also included the Sahel, was critical. Those are initiatives, those are efforts that the government in the United States encourages, and although we have no illusions about our ability to affect them, we stand ready to help the countries of the region, both of the Sahel and of North Africa, to do what is necessary and to provide them what assistance that they ask. This effort has been given, I think, increased urgency over the last couple of years because of the recent uptick in AQIM-related kidnappings and killings, and also indications that AQIM is looking for allies in the region, and of course you're aware of their use of some of the tribes. The Algerians have taken some initiatives internationally to try and get at this root issue of financing. It's very clear to us, I think, and to you in this room, that one of the reasons why kidnapping is so prevalent as part and parcel of this terrorism problem is because it's a fundraiser, let's be honest. The Algerians have seen firsthand how the ransom money is used to fuel the continuation and the spread of terrorism actions throughout the region. It has attempted to sponsor a UN Security Council statement criminalizing ransom payments. This statement did not receive the support of the Security Council in full, but the language was recently added to the Security Council Resolution 1904 on terrorism financing. Algeria continues to look for a broader international vehicle through which to condemn terrorism, such as a UN General Assembly resolution, which, of course, would be non-binding, but we think would give very broad exposure to this issue. Let me reiterate something that I was asked from time to time, both by the press and by governments when I was in the region. We do believe, the United States does believe, that the governments of the region are best equipped to combat the terrorism threat. Let's be frank. Overt U.S. government efforts in this regard are going to exacerbate the problem and make us the issue. We are there to support them. We are there to offer them the tools that they need. We are there to assist their efforts, but the lead must be the countries of the region working together. It's perhaps not the way that some of our friends would like to see, but frankly speaking, it is the only way that this effort between the Maghreb and the Sahel is really going to take root. Now, Bob Godak this afternoon is going to talk to you in a bit more detail about what the U.S. government is doing in that regard, but I'd like to mention a couple of things in closing. The first is that we have something called the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Effort, which has a cute little acronym. It's a $150 million multi-year effort, which includes training, equipping, and exchanges, and certainly includes efforts to raise the level of our dialogue and our discussion. We have the anti-terrorism effort of our diplomatic security branch of the Department of State, which primarily is training. The DOD, through 1206 support, also has training and exchanges to provide to the countries of the region. We are looking for opportunities to encourage the countries of the region to use regional organizations, including the AU and the AMU. We do understand there's a need for a political approach as well. This simply is not a problem of terrorism. I want to stress as well that the U.S. government effort includes increased outreach to the region, both to the countries with which we have had long, very strong relations, such as Morocco, as well as new countries. And in that effort, I would note to you that this is part and parcel of our outreach to Libya, a country with whom we have had a long period of freeze, but over the last couple of years, that relationship has begun to bear some fruit. We are appreciative of what John referred to very much at the beginning, that our engagement with North Africa in particular, which is the area I focus on, has been episodic in nature. Frankly speaking, 10 years ago when I was going off to Algeria, when we had a meeting like this, we could barely fill a conference table of 12. So it's a real pleasure for me to see the interest here. I want to also note that in my building, and certainly in the U.S. administration as a whole, there is an understanding that our relationship with the Maghreb and with the Sahel must go beyond simple terrorism. I did an interview a little while ago with a very inquisitive French journalist, and he tried to say, well, of course, your relationship with Morocco, that's a love affair. Your relationship with Algeria, that's an arranged marriage. It's way too simplistic. That's not the way it is. Our relations with these countries span a broad spectrum of interests, from economic to cultural to political, counterterrorism, security writ large. So for those of you who would say that simply on September 11th, the light went on and we thought, oh, we better think about Algeria, I would say you're wrong. It's too simplistic to look at it that way. We are only going to be successful in the Maghreb, I would argue, if we build a network of relationships that span all of our interests, including counterterrorism. I think at that I will leave and turn it over to my colleagues. I appreciate the time. This is a very important topic, obviously, for all of us, but it's a particularly important topic for the Maghreb and for their neighbors in the Sahel. And I hope and I think that this will kick off additional discussions down the road. So thank you.
Well, Ambassador Sanderson, I hope you're not leaving just yet. Just to show you how people's perceptions are not always accurate, your line about what the French journalist asked you. I remember speaking to a senior Indian military official and his wife and asking them how long they had been married, because they looked very much in love and they were in their 60s. And they said they'd been married about 40-odd years. And I said, why had the marriage lasted that long? And they said, because it was arranged. So, where you sit is where you stand, I guess. I really very much appreciate what you were telling us, not just because you're telling us what the State Department is thinking, but because you're speaking as somebody who really knows the way folks in that part of the world think. And one of the greatest challenges that we have as a national security community in this town, I don't think you'll disagree with me, is that very often we tend to overlook how the people think before we go ahead and make decisions about how we want them to think. Let me turn to Michael Braun. Michael is, what do you guys call yourself, retired Marines or former Marines? I'm trying to remember.
Former
Marines, because you never retire from the Marines. So he's a former Marine. He's also a specialist in law enforcement and security matters. Now he's a managing partner at Spectre Group, which is out in Northern Virginia. He was chief of operations at DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, until 2008. And in 2003, he was one of the many dedicated people who made a pilgrimage out to Iraq to try to sort that place out. It's taken a while. We're getting there. But he was present at the creation of the police and helped get that going, I guess, working with Walt Slocum and Dave Gompert and that crew out there. The usual suspects, all of whom I funded. He, before that, as I mentioned, he was an infantryman in the Marines. He's got a B.S. in criminal justice from Southeast Missouri State. He knows this business as well as anyone, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks. Over to you.
Can or can't do, rather, when I present.
And it's a Washington briefing, as you see.
Yeah, I can't sit still, I can't stand still, and I can't stand behind a podium. What I'm going to talk about today is the growing confluence of drugs and terrorism in North Africa. The title of the presentation or the theme is Out of Africa. As much as we would love to take that famous Las Vegas maxim, what goes on in Vegas stays in maxim, or stays in Vegas, and apply it to North Africa, it's not going to work. Because when you're talking about drugs, when you're talking about terrorism, what goes on in Africa does not stay in Africa. It goes far beyond, and I think that that will be very apparent by the time I'm finished with my comments and my presentation. You're going to see a few slides. It's not death by PowerPoint. I've only got about 100 of them. Actually, only about six or seven. But there are some things, the most important points that I want to really drive home are on these on the slides. You can read them. I'm just going to kind of walk through them. It's important before I start, though, to understand clearly, or as I start, to understand clearly that the growing confluence or growing nexus between drugs and terrorism isn't unique to Africa. It's happening globally. Mike, if you would, hit the first one. Of the 45 designated terrorist organizations, 44 through the formal State Department process won by Congress, the Taliban, just over half of those terrorist organizations are now connected to one or more aspects of the global drug trade. Why? Why is it happening? Three things are happening. State sponsorship for terrorism is on the decline, and if you don't subscribe to that, then understand that post 9/11, after we pulled the trigger on Afghanistan, after we pulled the trigger on Iraq, we certainly pushed things down deeper and made it much more difficult for nation states to overtly support terrorist groups. The second thing that's happening is our government working with our coalition partners. We've done yeoman's work at identifying very powerful private donors around the globe and significantly disrupting that stream of funding to terrorist groups. The third thing that's happening is somewhat unique to Al-Qaeda. And here it is. We have so significantly disrupted Osama bin Laden's ability to communicate to his cells and nodes around the globe that he has had to switch, or Al-Qaeda has had to move from a corporate kind of a management structure to a franchise management structure. What do I mean by that? Those cells and nodes folks have been left up to their own devices to shoot, move, and communicate. There was a mention, I believe, by one of the ambassadors of the Madrid train bombings. That was an Al-Qaeda affiliate. I don't care if it was an Al-Qaeda affiliate or if it was a card-carrying Al-Qaeda cell. The point being is that I believe it was 246 innocent folks died behind those horrific attacks, and that operation was funded almost in its entirety through the sale of hashish and MDMA. Okay? So more and more terrorist organizations globally, because of these reasons, are having to find other ways to pay for their operations. There's a lot of ways that you can do that. Obviously, the drug trade, that's what I'm going to talk about. Kidnapping for ransom, as Ambassador Sanderson talked about, extortion, bank robbery, knockoff designer clothing, for God's sakes, you name it, they'll do it. But the next slide, it will become painfully apparent that there's nothing that generates the kind of money in illicit markets that the global drug trade does. It's also important to understand that the cost of a terrorist attack doesn't cost a great deal. Madrid train bombings only cost about $70,000. The attacks on our country on 9/11 only cost about $500,000, folks. It doesn't cost a great deal to actually successfully attack any government or to pull off a successful terrorist attack. What does cost a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, is the funding and the care and the nurturing of your terrorist organization. Think about it. You've got to recruit them. You've got to indoctrinate them. You've got to equip them. You're working in a clandestine environment. You have to establish safe houses. You have to pay for counterfeit documents. You have to pay those fees to launder your funds that you make off of drug trafficking and other things. You've got to spend a lot of money to do all that. Mike, you would. So now let's look at the UN figures for the four greatest generators of contraband revenue to terrorist organizations, drug traffickers, and others. Okay, drug trade $322 billion annually, human trafficking at about $32 billion, arms trafficking at about $10 billion, and the black diamond trade at about $1 billion, mas and minus. Next, so let's move in to Africa now. Let's drop down to kind of treetop level, and let's talk about what's happening with respect to drug trafficking, drug abuse on the African continent, and we'll begin to talk about how it's tied to terrorist organizations and the like. There is an explosive growth of drug trafficking and abuse throughout North Africa. Well, really, it's happening across the continent. You've got to understand that with the growing demand for cocaine in Europe, Mexican and Colombian drug trafficking cartels are moving roughly about 250 metric tons of cocaine now through West Africa, onward through North Africa, through the soft underbelly of Europe to feed that growing demand in Europe. These very powerful, ultra-powerful drug cartels have created and expanded the market in Europe just over the past few years. They work with Fortune 100 corporate efficiencies. They have highly organized or highly sophisticated organizational structures, highly compartmentalized cells to thwart law enforcement and intelligence agencies and militaries. Remember, folks, I'm talking about drug cartels from Mexico and Colombia now. I'm not yet talking about terrorists. But some of the things I've already said should become apparent to you. These organizations operate almost identically to terrorist organizations. I've named some of the things: highly sophisticated organizational structures, highly compartmentalized cells. They rely on the latest in technology, communications, as well as navigation technologies to move massive loads of drugs to anywhere on the face of the globe with pinpoint accuracy. These cartels, as they're working now in West Africa, North Africa, and the reason they're there is because they've had to develop their transportation infrastructure or transshipment infrastructure to move these massive loads of cocaine out of Latin America and onward into Europe. In so doing, there are some things happening here. They're forming very close relations and alliances with indigenous organized crime and smuggling factions and groups throughout the African continent. Some of the nasty things that spin off as it relates to that, let me just identify a few of those. The indigenous groups, which for the most part historically have been rather unsophisticated, are now learning from the very best that global organized crime has to offer. If I ask you what comes to mind when you think of organized crime, most of you would immediately say John Gotti, okay? Or you'd say Sammy the Bull Gravano, his right-hand guy. Or you'd think of Al Capone or Lucky Luciano. Folks, on John Gotti's best day, he couldn't put together $1 million in cash. These organizations routinely lose $10, $15, $20 million, and they don't skip a heartbeat. They're far more violent, far more sophisticated than traditional organized crime ever was. And in our country, the reason we have been so successful at dismantling organized crime in our country is because they operate here. Law enforcement can identify them, investigate them, indict them, arrest them, bring them into a courthouse where they're tried by a jury of their peers, sentence them, and lock them up for the rest of their lives. We're very fortunate in our country. Most other countries can't do what I just described, and there are certainly few countries anywhere in Africa that can do what I just described, going after a threat as powerful and sophisticated as I'm talking about. Some other things that are happening here. The indigenous groups are being paid for with drugs. They're being paid in kind rather than in cash. And what happens as a result of that is those indigenous groups control the markets. They develop new markets. They expand those markets, but they control those markets on the African continent. I was recently briefing one of our senators on the drug caucus who was saying, Mike, how can this be happening? Cocaine is an expensive drug. How can some African nations be experiencing cocaine addiction and crack cocaine addiction and that kind of thing? Well, it's quite simple. When indigenous organized crime is being paid for in kind with drugs, they can charge anything that they want for those drugs, and they're still most likely going to make a great deal of profit. So a gram of cocaine in Guinea-Bissau to be cracked up or converted into base cocaine from hydrochloride, okay, doesn't cost $100 like it does in New York City or $150, okay? These guys can charge $10 for it, and they're still going to make an enormous profit. That's why we're seeing drug abuse and drug addiction all over many places of Africa right now. There's little stopping this from happening, by the way, and I think everyone understands that clearly. Next. Let's look at the strategic threat behind all of this. And this is the stuff that really worries me here. Designated foreign terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, AQIM, Hezbollah, Hamas, are operating the same space at exactly the same time in areas of Africa that very powerful Mexican and Colombian drug trafficking cartels are, okay? They're both working hard to create permissive environments. The term was used, ungoverned space, earlier, a favored term of our military. I prefer to use permissive environments. But they're occupying the same space at exactly the same time as these very powerful Mexican and Colombian drug trafficking cartels. What's taking place as a result of that? Well, let's talk about it. They're sharing lessons learned, okay? They're talking business. Why? Because they are staying in the same shady hotels. They are hanging out and rubbing shoulders in the same seedy bars. And I don't want to sound too crude here, but they're sharing the same prostitutes in the same sweaty brothels. And here's what bothers me and concerns me about this. This is the real strategic threat. This is what I lose sleep over, is the personal relationships that are being developed amongst these guys will undoubtedly, naturally evolve into strategic, organizational, or interorganizational alliances in the future. Why? Because if you're the head of a terrorist organization, or you're in a key leadership position, or you're the head of a major foreign drug trafficking cartel, you send your toughest young sergeants and lieutenants to places like Guinea-Bissau to move your agendas forward. And these tough sergeants and lieutenants will naturally ascend through the ranks of their respective organizations over the next decade because they're tough, okay? And they want to be rising stars. That's why they were sent to West Africa and to North Africa. They've got proven track records moving their boss's agendas forward. What concerns me, okay, drill a little bit deeper, is it's one thing to know that someone from Hezbollah corporate can pick up the phone and call someone from Hamas corporate or Al-Qaeda and ask for a favor. We know that that happens. We know that it's been happening for a long time. It's something entirely different, okay, to think that an Al-Qaeda operative in the next few years, maybe sooner, maybe it's happening already, has got the ability to pick up the phone and call a member of the FARC in Colombia, or worse yet, a member of the Sinaloa cartel on our Mexican border and ask for a favor.
Mike, okay? 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Next slide. We're almost at the end. So what's the way forward? Okay? Establish the rule of law. It's not easy and it's not cheap. I've been there. It's not easy, it's not cheap. But it's one of the most important things that we can do in fighting our nation's global war on terrorism. And it is an extraordinarily important aspect of any coin or counterinsurgency strategy. We need to develop fully vetted judicial paradigms. We've made lots of mistakes in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, okay? We become obsessed with building corruption-free law enforcement agencies. That's important. But if those cops have to deal with a corrupt judge or a corrupt prosecutor, then the whole judicial process falls apart like a house of cards. We need to develop and implement robust strategies designed to drive a wedge between these very powerful threats in places like Africa and our tri-border area in South America. We need to be doing everything that we can to keep them apart, and we're not, okay? I believe we need to significantly expand U.S. law enforcement presence in the African continent, as well as a law enforcement presence from our international partners. Why? Because it provides us with a very effective way to take information, oftentimes from very highly classified sources, sanitize it, get it in to your vetted counterparts' hands so that they can take the appropriate action at just the right time in just the right place to get the job done without compromising the means or methods by which you collected it or shared it, okay? And lastly, it facilitates the use of very strong, very robust U.S. extraterritorial jurisdiction. It's not for every country, but where there are countries where there is no rule of law, or virtually no semblance of the rule of law, this is where this comes in handy. One more time. And the reason, folks, is because, one more time, Mike, this is what foreign terrorist organizations and very powerful drug trafficking cartels fear the most. They fear justice meted out in a federal courthouse someplace in the United States. Most of them, quite frankly, wouldn't mind dying for the cause in a bloody gun battle. But the last thing that they want to do is spend the rest of their lives locked up in a federal penitentiary in Marion or FCI, Colorado. Thanks. I look forward to answering your questions.
Thanks very much. You know, We've been reading in the last couple of days that there's been a debate between our former vice president and our current vice president about whether the problem is one of foreign soldiers, foreign troops, or a criminal problem. I think what you've just heard is that it's really both. And then the question is, how do you deal with both? One of the things Michael mentioned was international partners. And in that context, I think, again, it's sometimes easier to get international partners on the law enforcement side than on the purely military side. And we have our third panelist, someone who can give us a perspective from one of our major partners in this part of the world and elsewhere. Jean-Pierre Filliou is professor of Middle East Studies at Sciences Po in Paris. He is part of the Center for International Studies and Research, CERI, there. I'm fascinated by his degree. I don't know too many people who have a degree like this. Chinese and Arabic from the Institut National des Langues et Civilisations Orientales. Obviously, he was thinking ahead when he got his degree. He has a Ph.D. in 20th century history, which he got in 1985, which is interesting because it was still the 20th century. So this is someone who clearly looks very far ahead. His research includes Islam, international relations, political violence, messianic movements. He's written in both French and English. I'm surprised he hasn't written in Chinese. But we're delighted to have you here and look forward to your comments.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be in D.C., even under those snowy circumstances. So I'm very thankful to CSIS, to John Alterman, to Chaim Malka, and the whole Middle East Center for inviting me. First, because I'm a long-time supporter of American engagement in North Africa. I think it's not only the law of history, because no matter what this biased journalist was asking Ambassador Sanderson, it has been more than two centuries that the United States of America have had diplomatic relationship with the North of Africa. And I've been myself an early supporter of the very balanced engagement of United States of America, and even its anticipation of the threats that we are talking about today, with the Pan-Sahel initiative as early as 2003 and its sequel, its widened sequel, the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, TSCTP, launched in 2005. But as Secretary Sanderson made it very clear, and I think that the key to all that, local governments are best equipped. You know, any direct or high-profile involvement from United States or from European country would be highly counterproductive, because it will play in the end of jihadis who want to stress the fact that they're fighting an infidel, quote-unquote, aggression. So, just very shortly, to give you my assessment of what is the AQIM threat in this part of the world, I will start by what is the beginning of all this, which is the invasion of Iraq. Invasion of Iraq is routinely called a divine blessing by Al-Qaeda propaganda. It significantly degraded the collective security of the European continent, and it created, in a place where there was no Al-Qaeda networks, a whole new branch of Al-Qaeda, and one of the most violent ones, under the leadership of the late Abu Musab Zarqawi. If I'm talking about Iraq regarding AQIM, it's because it is the key to the metamorphosis between an Algerian jihadi group, the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, GSPC, that was founded in 1998 at the end of what Ambassador Sanderson is recalled being called the Nightmare Decade, or the Black Decade of the 90s. And we have to remember that already at that time, GSPC had a Saharan branch that he had inherited from its mother organization, the GIA, Islamic Armed Group, that he was founded as a splinter group. So why Iraq matters? Because Iraq created a fateful triangle that fortunately didn't last after the surge in 2007, between North Africa, with a significant part of the foreign fighters and an even more significant part of the suicide bombers in Iraq coming from North Africa, and GSPC evolving as a regional hub for Al-Qaeda in Iraq in those days, incorporating for the first time of jihadi regional history elements from Morocco and Tunisia. And this fateful triangle involved what we call Iraqi networks in Europe, mainly France, Spain, and Italy. So the whole thing was, in fact, the background on which Al-Qaeda Central bet on incorporating this Algerian jihadi group, hoping that it could come much more global. And from the GSPC point of view, the key was to get access to Internet. Internet is a key resource in exchanges between Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, you know, opening the doors of the virtual global echo chamber is a main selling point for Al-Qaeda towards partner groups. So we should keep that in mind and consider that Internet is not only an issue of freedom of speech. And GSPC became Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in January 2007. But it largely failed in the three mandates or commitments that Al-Qaeda Central assigned to him. Because Iraq failed. Because there was a surge. So the surge was, of course, you know, the U.S. decision, but it was also the fact that the Iraqi guerrillas, the nationalist groups that were cooperating with Al-Qaeda before, turned against it in Anbar province, in Baghdad, and the defeat of Al-Qaeda in front of a jihadi, Arab, Sunni, anti-American force was a catastrophe for its recruitment and outreach potential, especially in North Africa and Europe. So fortunately, the fateful triangle collapsed at the very time AQIM was being launched. So there was a mismatch in the two. So the first failure was the failure of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb to become truly Maghrebi. It basically stayed an Algerian apparatus with a Saharan branch that I will quickly described in the second part of my talk. But the Moroccan, the Tunisian, didn't incorporate into Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And as Ambassador Sanderson recalled, the Libyan that had a long relationship with Al-Qaeda Central and most of their leaders were already based in Waziristan, they entered Al-Qaeda directly. They merged into Al-Qaeda without going into Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is basically GSPC. It's not more Maghrebi than that. The second failure was a failure to project terror on the northern shore of the Mediterranean. So, of course, you know, through sheer Gallic pride, I could explain to you that all this is because Italian, Spanish, French security are so good, so expert, they're working so well, that, of course, they could prevent all that. This is true, but it's only part of the answer. Basically, what happened was that the unplugging of Iraq or the collapse of Al-Qaeda in Iraq took off the main incentive for potential recruits to join Al-Qaeda-inspired networks. So basically, they couldn't recruit people over there, so they had to infiltrate them. And of course, it's much more complicated to infiltrate operatives in countries like mine or like Spain or Italy than to recruit people over there. So they're still relying on internet. Again, you know, I'm not a maniac about internet, but maybe some work should be done, you know, trying to have all this et message and terrorist guidance off the web once and for all. It can be done. Anyway, they couldn't recruit, so they couldn't export the terror. So they had to fall back on going global in the local environment. I mean, striking global, quote-unquote, targets, but in Algeria. And the most important one was, of course, the UN headquarters when they were hit by a suicide attack on December 11, 2007. Out of the 42 dead, 17 were working for the UN. And they tried frantically to kill the French in Algeria. They ultimately, after several failed attempts, killed a French engineer in June 2008. So striking global targets in the local environment, which was not exactly what Al-Qaeda had in mind. And the third failure is more related to the long, painful, bloody history of terror in Algeria, because Algeria has developed its own expertise and its way to fight this threat. And so you see, you know, a long-term tendency of decline of jihadi violence, which doesn't mean that it's not here anymore. But, you know, I did my little computing, you know, between official sources and press, and you can see that 2007 was an extraordinary year, but it is the only year when they could revert the trend of declining violence, mainly because of suicide attacks that were, especially in Algiers, that were very murderous, but that this trend, in fact, reverted to normal, to the normal trend, the declining trend, after 2007. Just few figures, you know, the casualties of terror in Algeria, 2007, 284, in 2009, 249. Out of them, the number of military killed, 1,071 in 2007, 171 in 2007, 188 in 2009. Number of civilians, 113 compared to 61 in 2009, which is also a long-term tendency because GSPC was founded as a way to protest GIA focusing on civilians and trying to target much more military forces. And I will mention in passing the number of terrorists, according to official sources, killed. You know, there's a significant number by the hundreds, but what is interesting is that there is an important increase in the arrest and in the surrenders of AQIM members. But maybe the most significant figure is the fact that in 2009 you had only one suicide attack compared to 2007, that was the year of the suicide attacks in Algeria, and that 60% of the violent actions by AQIM come from IEDs, not from physical attacks, from explosives. So all this in Algeria, because AQIM is a two-fold organization. You have the headquarters with Drugdal, mainly in Kabylia, and you had the contraction of the violence in Algeria. More than two-thirds, even three-quarters of the incidents are concentrated in what is called the Triangle of Death, Tizi Ouzou, Boumerdès, and Bouira provinces. And most of the rest of the territory is spared. And then you have the second branch, which is still pretty much under the control of Algerian terror operatives, with the deputy of Drugdal based in southern Algeria, Yahya Jouadi, and himself, you know, controlling two brigades, Katiba. You know, brigade is a propaganda name. There are not many roaming around in the Sahara. One in the west, which is coming from the GIA under Mortar Belmortar and mainly focusing on Mauritania, and one in the east under Abdelhamid Abu Zeid, which is the one that is most vocal or vibrant today because they are doing all the troubles they are doing now in Mali. So there is a long story of Al-Qaeda with Mauritania, you know, because Al-Qaeda's leadership lacks badly any religious, I wouldn't even say credential, but basically culture, you know, they know very little about Islam, you know, and the only ones who could get a little bit of Islamic message into them were in fact Mauritanians when they were in Kandahar. They were the one in charge of the political training, you know, Abu Hafs al-Mauritani and people like that. And even Abu Yahya al-Libi, with the most vocal spokesman, who is a Libyan, by the way, the place he learned some Islamic law was in Mauritania in the 90s. So you have that, and you had this long involvement that started from GSPC. You had clashes with the Mauritanian army as early as 2005, that were at that time praised by Al-Qaeda. And it kept on, no matter what were the political changes in Mauritania. You know, it can be democracy, it can be a military regime, it can be back to democracy. They don't care, they declare jihad, and they are trying to target Mauritania. And they are, you know, like in Algeria, there is a mix between global targets, you know, Israeli embassy in Nouakchott, humanitarian U.S. Ed Walker that was killed in Nouakchott in June 2009, and local targets like ambush against the Mauritanian army. What is crucial in the recent months is that Al-Qaeda got increasingly Al-Qaeda central. I don't have the key to the question that was raised by Ambassador Sanderson. By my understanding, is that Al-Qaeda Central kept the Algerian apparatus of the GSPC in place. They didn't try to revamp it like they did with Zarqawi after his death in Iraq. You have envoys, you have political commissars, but they left them in place, and they left them doing more or less what they were doing when they were still GSPC. But from time to time, they get pretty sore at the very limited global record of AQIM. And in that case, they put pressure on them. I will mention two sad developments in that regard. First one was when there is a long story of abduction of Western nationals by AQIM. It's nothing new. GSPC did that, you know, in 2003 they had 32 Western tourists abducted. It's mainly to get media exposure and financial compensation that weighs heavily in the financing of terror networks, as the Algerian government quite rightly put forward. But at that time, the spring of 2009, AQIM had four hostages, including a British citizen, and Al-Qaeda Central pressured AQIM into killing him, to prove that they were not only releasing, that from time to time they were killing crusaders, quote-unquote. So you had that. And a few weeks later, there was an incredible speech by Zawahiri. I think I saw all Zawahiri's speech. I think I read all his texts, unfortunately for me, because he's a very boring writer and speaker. But anyway, this day he discovered that France was the eternal enemy of Islam because Bonaparte had invaded Egypt. So after this historical discovery, he called for striking Crusader France, and 3 days later there was a foiled suicide attack against the French embassy in Mauritania. So you have always this pressure to try and get global. Before it was Paris-Dakar car race that was targeted. Now it has been moved to Latin America, so out of reach of AQIM. But you have this always this tendency to try and strike global. And you have also the global pretense of AQIM propaganda. I won't recall what Drugdal said during the Gaza offensive in January 2009, during the riot in Xinjiang in July 2009, even proposed recently to the Muslims in Nigeria his help to fight the Christians. All this is baloney, but it's very dangerous because it's circulating on internet and it can create not only an image of Drugdal as a global leader, but also attract here or there some new recruits. I will just end up with the abductions, because it falls up, it's very interesting, because the Saharan branch, which is roaming from Mauritania to Chad, has been, but again, it's nothing new. It has been going on for 10 years, cooperating with criminal networks, exchange of favors, smuggling of drugs, smuggling of weapons, smuggling of illegal immigrants, and because of many reasons, because of the pressure of Al-Qaeda Central, but also because of the need of replenish the finance of the organization, they let the message go all over the Sahara a few months ago, we need Western hostages. So you had three different sets of kidnappings that were all the works of criminal groups, not directly of Al-Qaeda, but those criminal groups delivered the hostages to Al-Qaeda in 24 to 48 hours. So first you had the three Spanish aid workers in Mauritania, then a French retired gentleman was doing humanitarian work in northern Mali, and a third occurrence was a couple of Italian at the Mauritanian-Malian border. So now they are holding them, and of course all our thoughts and solidarity goes to the families of the abducted. But again, one could get the impression that they will handle this more AQIM, GSPC way than Al-Qaeda way. So I don't say it's a reason to rejoice, but at least that makes a big difference to the people involved. So I will just end up by saying that, yes, Al-Qaeda is a very serious threat. It's basically a threat to the countries involved that have already developed regional cooperation to help control more and more their borders. And all the help we can give to those governments and security forces in achieving those goals will be, of course, very positive to deter and contain this threat in the Maghreb and Sahel regions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Professor Filia, and your observations about the essential Algerian nature still of AQIM is really very enlightening. I'm going to ask John Alterman's indulgence to give us five extra minutes, since it's actually a favor to me because I was late. What I'll do is have take bunches of questions and bunches of three, and please identify yourself and identify to whom you're directing your question, and we'll try to catch as many as of you as we can in the next 15 minutes. I saw a hand up there, please.
Eric Goldstein from Human Rights Watch. It's a question for Secretary Sanderson and perhaps for Professor Filiou. In Morocco and in Tunisia, a significant proportion, if not the majority of people currently in prison for terrorism were convicted not for committing or preparing acts of terrorism in their countries, but rather for wishing to or plotting to go to join the jihad in Iraq or elsewhere. And that continues to be the case in both countries until today. And I'm sorry, I don't know if it's the same in Algeria or Libya to the same extent, but my question is to what extent is there continuing in the U.S. view to be active recruiting networks of people to filter local youth to jihad in Iraq or elsewhere? Is this something that is run by AQIM, or is it local? In most cases, the defendants claim that all they did was talk about the jihad, or they downloaded or shared DVDs, jihadist DVDs. I can't say whether that's true and to what extent, but to what extent does the U.S. have concerns about recruiting and these mass convictions of young people on charges of wishing to go or plotting to go to join the jihad? Thank you.
Okay. Over there, gentleman in the back there with the beard. You. Yeah. The one who just turned around for a mic.
I'm Leon Weintraub, University of Wisconsin, Washington Semester in International Affairs. I'd like to ask Ambassador Sanderson, you spoke about trans-Sahara issues, and two countries you mentioned were Niger and Mauritania. I'd like to ask you about Nigeria, particularly the recurrence of Muslim-Christian violence in northern Nigeria. Now, as most of us know, this has been happening for decades, going back to the early years of Nigerian independence. But I'm wondering if this is a fertile ground for instability that might be aggravated by these people. For example, instability in Nigeria would affect a tremendous amount of oil exports. It's the most populous country in Africa. It's also been a great support for ending the wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone through the African Union and ECOWAS. I'm wondering if you see elements of AQIM or other groups that are trying to aggravate the already significant level of Muslim resentment in northern Nigeria.
Okay. Third one, right there, center.
Princeton Lyman, Council on Foreign Relations. This is for Mr. Brown. You didn't mention controlling demand, and it seems to me that the irony is that the U.S. and the Europeans are financing the entire operation you talk about by our drug habits. And I wonder if by linking the drug trade more to terrorism, it will focus more attention on demand, and why you don't think that's a way of getting at this problem.
Okay, let's take the panelists, just start with Ambassador Sanderson and move to the left.
Right, well, thank you very much. With regard to, it's interesting about the issue now of recruitment in both Morocco and Tunisia, because when I was in the region most recently, it wasn't brought up. And it is something we watch very closely. We are concerned, for instance, about what academicians and others call the root causes of terrorism. In other words, the economic challenges that are present in many of the countries in the Maghreb and elsewhere that can give rise to people who are so desperate that they are looking for any possible out, including joining up with an organization that says they're going to solve all their problems. In Morocco in particular, we've tried to get at this by programs for rehabilitation of youth that are leaving prison, job creation, and other types of socialization and rehabilitation, because we recognize if they are in a situation where they don't think they have anything waiting for them when they leave prison, that they may turn to those more hardened criminals in the prison, including some that are terrorists. With regard to recruitment, as I say, it was not an issue that was discussed with me in any detail. I think in broadest terms, we do worry that if the economic conditions in some of these countries don't catch up with the aspirations of the countries, that there will be a fertile breeding ground for those people, for better or for worse, for whatever reason, are quite susceptible to the persuasions of others. So, yeah, it's something we worry about. With regard to Nigeria, I have to confess, the State Department has a very strange way of looking at the continent, and North Africa is in a different bureau than Sub-Saharan Africa. But let me take a stab at it. It's very clear to us that instability in Nigeria can and is to a certain extent being exploited by those who would like to use it either to focus on destabilizing sub-Saharan Africa as a whole or going after us and others who they see as causing some of their problems. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why we are looking particularly at Nigeria and in terms of trying to work with the Nigerian government and the Nigerian people to provide some wherewithal to address these problems through aid and through other efforts. We are all aware of the fundamental problems that Nigeria has faced with regard to various religions and how the government has gone about addressing them. So it is something we do worry about. I know I went with Ambassador Carson, Johnny Carson, our Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, and Ambassador Huddleston, who's going to talk on the next panel, to talk to the French in general about what we're doing in the Sahel. And we did actually get into the issue of Nigeria and what was happening there. So perhaps I can leave that to Vicky in the next panel. Sorry, Vicky.
Okay. Mr. Braun.
Listen, I firmly believe that...
Hit your mic. Oops. Not too hard. But
okay. Firmly believe that demand reduction treatment demand reduction education treatment are very important pieces of any successful counter-narcotics strategy. Let me make that perfectly clear. In fact, anywhere in the world, I mean, you look at any country in the world that's had a successful counter-narcotics strategy, and those, you know, those three aspects or dimensions are receiving at least equal treatment. We don't necessarily have to add the fourth in North Africa, at least with respect to cocaine, because there is no cocaine being produced there, so we don't have to worry about eradication, which is very important also. But with all that said, the way that I look at the problem and the situation is the reason we're seeing this explosive use and very aggressive marketing of drugs in Africa is because there is so much ungoverned space. There are so many permissive environments that these very powerful drug trafficking cartels from Latin America, are working hard to destabilize governments. And if you don't have security first, you know, in my mind, I don't know how you get to education, prevention, and treatment. And things are so bad in places like Guinea-Bissau that has become kind of the center of gravity with respect to, you know, Colombian Mexican drug trafficking cartels. Many are referring to the state as a narco state now. You know, you'll never get to prevention, education, treatment, until you bolster security and you establish a rule of law. So that's the point that I would like to make.
Professor Fillier.
Yes, Iraq was really the name of the game for AQIM, but I want to point out that something that is not very seldom underlined, that Al-Qaeda is an Arab outfit, and Al-Qaeda has a very deep racial problem. You know, they have a real problem incorporating people who are non-Arabs. And this problem is very valid with AQIM also. I don't see any AQIM or any potential recruit from North Africa going to fight in Waziristan today, and certainly not going to join any sectarian trouble in Jos, Nigeria. Even now, as I mentioned, AQIM is fully run by Algerians, and even if they try to reach out to some Africans, they never co-opted them to any responsibility position. This is something that it's a dirty little secret of Al-Qaeda. You know, they don't like Africans. By the way, they don't like blacks. And when President Barack Obama was elected, the first reaction by Zawahiri was to call him a house Negro, which in Arabic is Abid, and is a very, very dirty way to talk at anybody, which is in fact slave. And you have a deep unconscious experience of all, if we are talking about Sahara, Sahara was one of the main route for slave trade for centuries. And the traders were, a lot of them were Arabs, you know. And you have that, and I frankly doubt any AQIM operative being able to really reach out to non-Arab issue. Even if we are not talking about sub-Saharan Africa. Take, for example, the Chinese issue. You have now tens of thousands of Chinese expatriates in Algeria, who are pretty active. After the Xinjiang riots, AQIM called for retaliation to take revenge for the blood of the Muslim brothers in Xinjiang. Nobody cared because nobody cared about the Uyghur, even in the most extreme jihadi community. So this whole racial ethnic dimension is very often underplayed, but is really at the root of a lot of the jihadi dynamics, including the one of AQIM.
Thank you. We're really running out of time, so I'll take two questions, but they got to be really short. John? You're pulling rank here, you know. But I'm going to cut you off after
that. I'm
going
to be really quick. Has Al-Qaeda become less ideological, as you've all described it, or were we wrong in assuming in 2001 that Al-Qaeda was fundamentally ideological to start with?
So I'll take two more as well. I mean, I got to be fair back there. But please, keep it short.
Leonard Oberlander. This is a question for Mr. Braun. As you went through your description of the nature of the organizations and how the bosses were evolving, I thought of this question: to what extent do they, as an organization, use information and transaction data regarding their recruits, their inventory, and financial, and regarding the decisions and movements, if they have the information, of our military personnel, police, and counter-terrorist organizations and activities? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, last one.
Wondering if any piracy money is going to AQIM or affiliates, wondering if there's any Salafist backlash to the use of drug marketing to propagate Islam, which seem to be contrary to all principles of the Hadith and of the Quran.
Well, thank you very much. Let's just, again, roll right down the panel here. Ambassador Sanderson.
Well, good question, John. We're trying to tackle with that with regard to Yemen as well, to be perfectly honest, which I also handle. I'm going to punt on that and suggest you ask Bob Godek.
That is quite an answer. Okay, Mr. Braun?
A couple of comments. First of all, with respect to ideology, and I'm talking from the 30,000-foot level here, and I'm not just talking about Al-Qaeda, but what we have seen with the evolution of hybrid terrorist organizations, meaning one part designated terrorist organization, one part global drug trafficking cartel. Here's what we have seen happen time and time again. If you look at the FARC in the Western Hemisphere, use them as the case model, we're seeing the same exact thing happen with the Taliban. The FARC has been around for 45 years. They got their start in 1964. They were diabolically opposed to any involvement in the drug trade until 17, 18 years ago with the breakup of the Soviet Union. Their state sponsorship, or one of their funding streams from state sponsorship, dries up. They make a corporate decision in about 5 minutes to get themselves involved in the global drug trade. In 17 years, 17 short years, they have gone from a purely ideology, a terrorist organization driven by ideology, to a terrorist organization that is now motivated by greed, absolutely motivated by greed. Once corporate gets a taste for the money, ideology, quite frankly, goes out the window. What corporate continues to do is rely heavily on ideology to recruit and to indoctrinate, to brainwash, quite frankly, if you will, many of the young fighters that they need to do the dirty work. Again, same thing's happening with the Taliban. And by the way, there is more and more evidence flowing through the door of Al-Qaeda's involvement in the heroin trade in Afghanistan, the Afghan PAC region. With respect to the question from the gentleman over to the left, these organizations do a great deal of due diligence with respect to when they promote individuals through the ranks. Oftentimes, these organizations rely heavily on familial contacts and that kind of thing. So they do rely very heavily, and they do a great deal of due diligence on who they bring into the fold. With that said, they also are masters at collecting, collating, analyzing intelligence. Okay, and they have principally much of it is brought about by their heavy use of corruption. These organizations rely heavily on the hallmarks of organized crime. If they can't corrupt you, and they've got hundreds of millions of dollars a year that they spend in Africa alone to corrupt, okay? If they can't corrupt you, they will intimidate you. If intimidation doesn't work, they'll resort to extreme violence. But they will find out what they want to know, whether it's about our military or any other military or government security institution around the globe.
Okay, Professor Fillier.
Yes, thank you. Al-Qaeda is a totalitarian organization whose ultimate goal is to establish a revolutionary caliphate in Mecca and Medina. Once said, they have developed a cult approach with Bin Laden as a charismatic guru and a new dogma disseminated through internet. You had a lot of cults of this kind in the 14th century old history of Islam, but they never got internet. So ultimately, they faded away. So the problem is that they're not ready to do that. They're still sticking to the Mecca and Medina perspective, which is why Yemen is so crucial for them, because they hope to come back to the country where they were expelled a few years ago. What is certain is that their level of ideological expertise is very low. Their lack of religious culture is abysmal. They lost the support of even the most radical sheikh that were one way or another condoning their terror. So if there is a Salafi backlash, it's not only about the drug dealing. It's a general Salafi backlash, which doesn't make the Salafi peace lover, woman defenders, or democratic born again, you know. But they are certainly anti-jihadi for many reasons. So that's where we stand now. And I think in the many defeats Al-Qaeda had faced during the recent year, this ideological route is a major one and could be the key to its failure and its end.
Well, thank you very much. This has been an excellent kickoff. I want to thank each of the panelists. We got three very, very different and yet overlapping and complementary perspectives. And thank you all for your questions as well. Thank you.